Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar. Today, September 2nd, 2026, we are delighted to host a conversation entitled Bias, DEI, and CLE, Navigating the Constitutional Limits of Mandatory Training. My name is Emma Blakemore, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I'll keep my introduction brief, but if you would like to know more about our panelists, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Professor Josh Blackman, Professor William Jacobson, and Daniel Lannington as our panelists, with Professor Michael McGinnis serving as moderator. Professor McGinnis is Professor of Law and the J. Philip Johnson Faculty Fellow at the University of North Dakota School of Law, where he joined the faculty in 2010 and served as the dean from 2019 to 2022. He chairs the Executive Committee for the Federalist Society's Practice Group on Professional Responsibility and Legal Education. And I will leave it there. As a reminder to any attendees that are seeking CLE credit, we will be posting a CLE code in the chat box at some point during the presentation. At that time, a slide will appear noting that the CLE code has been posted. Please write this code down because you'll be required to provide it at the conclusion of the webinar when you complete your attendance reporting form. Written materials for this event were emailed to all registrants prior to the webinar, and a link to the written materials will be available shortly in the chat box. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, we ask that you please submit them through the question and answer feature below so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. And with that, thank you for being with us today. I will turn things over to Professor McGinnis to introduce our panelists and to start the conversation.
Thank you very much, Emma, and greetings to everyone. Thank you for joining us for today's webinar. It's my honor to serve as the moderator with such a distinguished panel. Just the topic of our webinar, jurisdictions are increasingly requiring attorneys to complete CLE credits addressing bias, diversity, and inclusion in the legal profession. These requirements are often justified as tools to help lawyers reduce bias and ensure competent representation of clients from varied backgrounds. But these mandatory programs also raise significant and unsettled questions about how the profession may regulate bias in a manner consistent with federal law. When does a required course permissibly educate lawyers about bias, discriminatory conduct, barriers to access to justice, or cultural competency in legal practice? And when might mandatory training cross the line into compelled speech, viewpoint discrimination, or race or sex conscious practices that conflict with constitutional principles or civil rights statutes? So to help us explore these issues, it's my honor to now introduce our panelists. I'll introduce all three and then turn it over to them for their opening statements. And as Emma noted, if you have questions that you'd like to pose at the end of the program, please include those in the Q&A function rather than the chat. I'll also have a few questions to pose to our panelists as well. So we'll start with Professor Josh Blackman. He is a national thought leader on constitutional law and the United States Supreme Court. His work was quoted during two presidential impeachment trials. He has testified before Congress and advises federal and state lawmakers. He regularly appears on TV, including NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, and the BBC. He's also a frequent guest on NPR and other syndicated radio programs. He's published commentaries in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and leading national publications. Since 2012, Josh has served as a professor at the South Texas College of Law in Houston. He holds the Centennial Chair of Constitutional Law. He's an adjunct fellow at the Professor Manhattan Institute. He's written more than two dozen law review articles that have been cited more than 1,000 times. He was selected as Jurist of the Year by the Texas Journal of Law and Public Policy, received the inaugural Mies III Originalism Award, and was awarded the inaugural Joseph Story Award. He was selected by Forbes magazine as for the 30 Under 30 in Law and Policy. He's a president of the Harlan Institute and founded Fantasy SCOTUS, the internet's premier Supreme Court fantasy league. And he blogs at the Vol Conspiracy and posts at Josh M. Blackman as well. Next, my pleasure to introduce Daniel Lennington. He serves as deputy counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Liberty, Law and Liberty, where he directs the Equality Under Law, or EUL project. Starting in early 2021, the EUL project has represented dozens of individuals and businesses nationwide, successfully advocating for race neutrality in both public and private programs. Before joining Will, Dan served as an assistant deputy attorney general in Wisconsin and as an assistant U.S. attorney in Oklahoma, and he is a proud graduate of Hillsdale College. He can be reached at dan@will-law.org, and it's my pleasure to have him with us today. Last but not by no means least is Professor William Jacobson, who's a clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic. He's a 1981 graduate of Hamilton College and a 1984 graduate of Harvard Law School. He was the senior editor of the Harvard International Law Journal and director of litigation for the Harvard Prison Legal Assistance Project. Before he joined the Cornell Law faculty in 2007, he had a highly successful civil litigation and arbitration practice in Rhode Island, concentrating in investment, employment, and business disputes in the securities industries, including many high-profile cases reported in leading newspapers and magazines. He's argued cases in numerous federal and state courts, including the Courts of Appeals for the First, Fifth, and Sixth Circuits, and the Rhode Island Supreme Court. He has a national reputation as a leading practitioner in securities arbitration. He was treasurer as a former member of the Executive Committee and Board of Directors of the Public Investors Arbitration Bar Association, a professional organization of attorneys dedicated to protecting public investors. He is frequently quoted in national media on issues related to investment, fraud, and investor protection, and in the past has served as one of a small number of private practice attorneys who train new mediators for the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. He's also co-author of the Securities Arbitration Desk Reference with Thomson Reuters, updated annually. And lastly, he is the founder and publisher of Legal Insurrection, a popular politics and law website. He's frequently quoted in the media on political and legal topics, has authored many op-eds in major publications, and appears in television and radio to discuss politics and the law. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our three panelists for their opening remarks, and I'll begin with Professor Blackman.
Thank you so much. The topic of this panel has been germinating for a while. Bias, DEI, and CLE. So in the abstract, there's nothing wrong with lawyers who want to learn about DEI and anti-bias regimes. I think the problem creeps in when it becomes mandatory. And this appears, I think, in a couple different contexts. It appears in the context of certain bars, which mandate that their members attend certain DEI training. In fact, I think many of you watching, I see over 130, I feel like Trump, 135 people watching, right? There are all these people watching, turn the camera around. And many of you are probably here for the sole reason that you need this DEI credit to keep your law license. But it's not just attorneys, it's also law students. Some years ago, the American Bar Association basically adopted a rule that mandates a cross-cultural competency and anti-racism training, basically. This is standard 206, we'll talk about a little bit more later. And the problem here goes even further. About 10 years ago, it's been a decade, the ABA put forward Model Rule 8.4G. And this was a rule which was designed to eliminate bias in the legal profession. And I think all of these programs, both the mandatory DEI, CLE, standard 206, and 8.4G stem from the same root belief that the legal profession is not just about, you know, providing legal services and making sure lawyers are competent to their clients, that the legal profession has some sort of higher duty, some sort of higher obligation to improve our society, that we're obligated to be aware of structural inequalities in our society, and that the legal apparatus has an obligation to eradicate these perceived biases in our profession. As I will explain, I think my colleagues will probably agree, this is wrong. Being a lawyer is a hard job. I'm a professor. Professor Jacobson teaches as well. Mike teaches as well. I'm sure Dan's done some CLE work. We have a fulsome duty to teach our students and our colleagues how to be ethical lawyers. And there are a lot of rules of ethics you have to keep in mind, how to treat your client, how to maintain confidentialities, how to manage client funds. These are all essential. But what happens is that these institutions like the ABA invariably creep left, and they see the legal profession as just another conduit to achieve their social mission. This also appears in the context of what's called barfare. Now, your friend Michael's writing an article on this. You've heard of lawfare. This is barfare. That is using bar disciplinary proceedings to go after people you don't like. So they're going after the Florida Attorney General. They're going after lawyers in D.C. and New York who are basically engaged in conservative jurisprudence. And they're saying that they're actually violating their oath. And ultimately what happens is when the legal profession becomes politicized, the need for the profession seems less important. And I got to focus on the ABA again because it's at the center. Right, the ABA proposed Model Rule 8.4G a decade ago. Only a handful of states adopted it. And even one state, Pennsylvania, that adopted it had to basically rewrite it to try to avoid a constitutional challenge. The ABA was once sort of the gold standard for these rules. And people said, you know what? We don't want this moralism creeping into profession. Let lawyers focus on being good lawyers. So that the ABA, again, they adopted Standard 206, which basically imposed a DEI requirement on law schools. Some law schools willingly wanted this. They said, yes, let's do this. We can mandate a professor teach this stuff. Other law schools like, well, this is, you know, we have to teach like torts and, you know, contracts. You don't have time for all this other stuff. This is not our job. Trump administration comes into office and they basically threaten the ABA that we're going to yank your accreditation. What's remarkable is that the Council on Legal Education basically said, let's suspend this rule and try to repeal it. And what did the ABA House of Delegates do? They said, no. We're going to keep it. You can't get rid of it, which is remarkable. They have no idea what time it is at all. They're clueless. And so now the ABA might lose its accrediting power to the Department of Education. And so the upshot is when you have these entities like the ABA, both the Section of Legal Education, the section that produces the model rules, when they sort of creep and they depart from the traditional boundaries of what a legal regulatory agency does, they lose support from half the population. I think it's a very sad and unfortunate state of affairs. So ultimately, we're not going to have these entities anymore that maybe serve some value, but don't. Now, the sort of fundamental problem is these DEI regimes presume neutrality. This is one of my favorite traits of the left. They presume that their views are neutral and then we're the crazy ones, right? This is just how they view the world. So they assume, of course, who could oppose racism? Well, the problem is with DEI, as we well know, it basically assumes that society is structurally inequitable, that's all based on race, there's no other explanation for it, and that the way to sort of remediate that is to engage in these overt racial preferences, racial quotas, and genuflecting. We have to sort of suppress speech that's deemed harmful, and we need to basically elevate speech that disparages us, right? So when you have these regimes that intrude on free speech, that intrude on religious liberty, that intrude on rights of association, invariably it will not work. So when I gave this similar talk, I think it was for the Missouri Bar, the Minnesota Bar some years ago, it was a very different world, sort of maybe a peak wokeness in 2022 or 23 or so. I think now we're sort of going down the slope and, you know, invariably slopes come back up. But I think it's very worthwhile that many of you are now getting credit for your DEI credits while I'm here attacking those credits. So I hope that the good bar council from your states are watching this. Hi, my name is Josh. Good to talk to you. Your requirements are ridiculous, but I'm going to talk about why they're bad and why they're unconstitutional. And hope you all get your credit for the bar. Thank you so much. And I'll turn it over to whoever's next. Thank you.
Yeah, so I wanted to begin by just sort of outlining what is a typical mandate and what do these look like in practice? Like, what do we see when we walk into the classroom of a DEI CLE? So about 13 states, including Rhode Island, where Bill is, have mandatory CLE requirements for different topics they label as diversity, equity, inclusion, or more recently, elimination of bias, cultural competency. About 15 other states have optional rules where they allow you to take these sort of classes to meet your overall CLE requirements. We in Wisconsin just adopted this 2 years ago, and we opposed this. Justice Bradley wrote a long dissent explaining, which is in my materials, which is really an interesting evaluation of these sorts of programs. But just to start out, the typical rule just has pretty much two definitions. They say cultural competency means a course designed to improve client communication and representation through the lens of knowledge and understanding of diverse populations. So that's what cultural competency is. And of course, that's not really a definition. It has all the buzzwords. It obviously means racial diversity. They never use the word race. Typically, they don't use the word race in these sorts of definitions because they want to get around that. Cultural competency has always been a buzzword. We have a client, Will, who was fired for not being culturally competent in a school district, primarily because she was the person who was white and her colleagues were not white. And so she scored the lowest on her cultural competency score by virtue of being a white woman. So cultural competency typically is a subterfuge for race discrimination. And then reduction of bias, again, you know, they'll say things like educate attorneys to identify and reduce the legal profession and the legal system's biases against persons because of, but not limited to, and then listing many, many different categories, race, color, creed, national origin, veteran status, sexuality, those sorts of things, and to remove barriers. What you won't find in these, apart from these lofty definitions and very generic definitions, you'll find no quality controls. No bar will actually put any quality controls in the rule. They'll never have a model curriculum. They'll never have a model syllabus. There will be no specific definitions, no measurable standards, no way to measure whether this actually works. And phrases like reduction of bias are not actually defined in a way to eliminate stereotypes, like a stereotype like the Supreme Court said in SFFA, where Harvard said a black student can bring something to the table that a white person cannot. That is a stereotype that is not sought to be eliminated by these rules. And also, I have in my materials, there's a growing body of evidence showing that none of this actually works. DEI training has not been proven an effective means in fields where it's been long-standing practice. Mandatory DEI training has been shown to actually increase bias in many situations. And studies show that there's no evidence that CLEs in particular actually improve the legal profession. Present CLE excluded here. So what's the typical content that we see, though? We've evaluated a number of these in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Some of our attorneys have attended some of them. There's one in particular that I'll quote from at the University of Wisconsin that happened a year and a half ago. They typically start off with, everybody has racial bias. We're all in the same boat. But it shortly devolves into the biggest problem are the whites. Quote, only white people can be racist. We've heard that in a CLE. All whites are infected with, quote, whiteness, white guilt, denial, fear, and privilege. Whites are all advantaged and all privileged, quote, based on the white color of your skin. Another CLE leader said white people, quote, fear people of color and what would happen if they gained control. This was all said in a mandatory CLE at UW-Wisconsin. What does this have to do with the legal profession? I'm not quite sure. It's mostly social engineering, social grievance talk. What they attack in these CLEs is non-discrimination. The biggest target of the CLEs is the colorblind society, probably the worst phrase you could utter in front of these people. Aspirations for non-discrimination are all racist. It's a racist to oppose affirmative action is another common thing you'll hear in these CLEs. Racist structures, as Josh said, obviously they pervade society, and this is all evidenced by racial disparities. So every time you see a racial disparity, it's proof that discrimination exists and racism pervades our society. Certain minorities, mostly Blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans are the victims. Asians and whites are not victims. So mandatory DEI CLE, for the most part, they preach the gospel of American systemic racism, which sounds more like a hoax than an actual legal theory or a social theory. They say that all disparities are caused by racism and all disparities, your clients, your results, your employees, the people who you serve and the results you get in court, the people you hire in your law firm or at your law school, you've got to root out. It's your job as the lawyer. You have to root out those disparities because that's the way you fix race discrimination. And it all goes back to rebalancing, a racial rebalancing. And this is your duty as an attorney, employer, officer of the court. That's what we see when we take a look at these CLEs. They want you to take action to root out discrimination, which means basically to end non-discrimination and end the colorblind society. And we'll discuss in a little bit, these are not only antithetical to American values and Western moral tradition, but they just are in complete conflict with federal state law and the U.S. Constitution.
Thank you, Dan. Professor Jacobson.
Thank you for having me. And I want to emphasize a lot of the points that have been made and make a couple of others, sending my greetings from the state of Rhode Island, until about 3 years ago, known as the state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. But the name of the state was changed as part of the mad dash, DEI dash post-George Floyd, because even though historically plantations did not have to do with slavery in Rhode Island, it meant something very different. There was a mass virtue signaling push, which also came to be in our CLE rules. So in 2023, I believe it was at the instigation of the Rhode Island Bar DEI Committee, who knows what they actually do, but the Rhode Island Supreme Court issued a proposal and opened it for comment to change our CLE rules, which are regulated by the Supreme Court in Rhode Island, and to require of the 10 mandatory credits that one of them be in diversity, equity, and inclusion. I filed an opposition to it on my own behalf and also on behalf of the Equal Protection Project. So Legal Insurrection is not just a political website, it's also a foundation. And one of our key projects is the Equal Protection Project, which brings legal challenges to discrimination done in the name of DEI. And the reason that we opposed it, that I opposed it, is one, the mandatory nature of it. It created a reasonable appearance that the Supreme Court, and therefore the court system, was taking sides in a hotly contested political and legal issue. The politics were essentially what you would see on any college campus, which is critical race theory, DEI, whatever you want to call it, essentially Ibram Kendi's formulation that attributes any disparate outcome to racism and requires people to be actively anti-racist. So in his formulation, which became something of a religion on campuses for 3 to 4 years, it's died down a little, failing to be anti-racist made you racist. And so, and in fact, that was the Cornell formulation. In July of 2020, Cornell president initiated an anti-racism initiative, and the suggested reading was Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. It's been a complete disaster, but the school's clinging to it, bitter clingers, although they've changed the name. They now call it Inclusion and Belonging instead of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. We took the position that, you know, there were existing at the time in 2023 DEI-style CLE programs, which people could take voluntarily and get credit. And we weren't challenging that, but it was the mandatory nature, and particularly the way the proposed amendment was worded certainly suggested a Kendian sort of outlook. It was DEI shall include programs that recognize the diversity of society and teach attorneys to effectively serve and have regard for multilingual, multiracial, multireligious, and multigender society while focusing on equity. And that's a key term. While focusing on equity by highlighting equal opportunity and outcomes for all. So that is very much a radicalized DEI perspective, a Kendian perspective, which was now being incorporated into the rules of the Rhode Island Supreme Court as to what qualifies as a DEI credit and DEI program. So we opposed that as being one hotly contested, as was pointed out. There's no evidence that any of this programming actually works and makes things better. And there's plenty of evidence that it makes things worse. And I think we all know from our own lived experiences that forcing people to endure this doesn't actually improve anything. It also was, in our view, contrary to law, that this focus on equity and outcomes was contrary to the United States federal law, contrary to Rhode Island law, which for the purpose of discrimination essentially mirrors federal law. And therefore, rather than focusing on the rights of individuals, which is what our federal and state constitutions are about, this is focusing on group outcomes. And so our position was there's no evidence it works. It's hotly contested because it's essentially Kafka trapping that, you know, under Kendi's formulation, your denial of being racist is the proof of your racism. And it's contrary to law. So why are we doing this? And what good will come out of it? Well, obviously, I wrote that lengthy letter to the Supreme Court, not exactly expecting it to succeed, and it didn't succeed. They did pass the rule. And so now, under this broad outcome-oriented definition of what is DEI, we are required to take one of our 10 credits for DEI. In practice, I'm not really sure anybody actually follows the Supreme Court's formulation of what DEI is. I just went to the Rhode Island Bar Association annual meeting to get all my credits. And I know I signed up for a couple of things that were DEI credits that really had nothing to do with any of these topics, any race or anything, more emotional oriented, things like that. And they call them DEI. So I'm not really sure what it means. But what we did do at Equal Protection Project is we gathered up the three conservative lawyers in Rhode Island, including me, and we formed our own DEI CLE program. And we got it approved. We said, well, look, if you're going to force us to do this, we will give people an out. We're not going to force them to endure a Kendian sort of hour in their life. And so we created a DEI CLE program. We got it approved by the Rhode Island Bar Association. So we could have done it outside, but really to get people to sign up, you need to go through the Bar Association. It was a little bit of back and forth, and they were very helpful. I don't really have any criticisms, but they were very concerned that this might turn into a political sort of discussion, attacking DEI. And so we had to massage it and work through it. Very well attended, shockingly well attended. I don't remember the precise number, but I think we had 50 plus people, which for a Rhode Island CLE is really good. And that's what we did. So what you have now is a defined DEI credit definition in the rules that nobody actually seems to follow. This was all virtue signaling. This is all the remnants of post-George Floyd purges in 2020 and mad rush for DEI that captured the campuses. And of course, what happens on campuses never stays on campuses. So I'm not sure what they're achieving by this, but we did object to it. I think it's improper. I think it should not have been done. I don't think anybody actually takes it seriously, but it's just put in your hour and do it. But I think it is pernicious. I think it has encouraged perhaps the various DEI committees around the state to push harder and further to prove that they are more virtuous than everybody else. And so that's where we are in Rhode Island. We opposed it, couldn't stop it. So we're doing it on our own. And I think people welcome a neutral sort of topic. And the topic of our CLE was, is DEI still legal after Students for Fair Admissions? And so that's where we are in the state of Rhode Island, formerly known as the state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations.
Thank you, Professor Jacobson. Thank you, all of you, for those excellent opening remarks, very informative and very thoughtful. So I'm going to start by posing a couple questions just for to basically put them out there for whoever would like to respond to it. You know, this idea of training, you know, the idea that your CLE is supposed to be providing you some form of structured information that relates to the practice of law, right? That the idea is it's supposed to be maintaining minimum competence as you continue through your legal career. This idea of constituting these as trainings, though, is that I'm just interested in additional thoughts. So you probably may have already touched on this a little bit in your opening thoughts, but how this pertains to if you're compelled to be present for this, for a presentation in which a particular form of instruction is being given about what these concepts mean and they're contested concepts, but also kind of sometimes touch on deeply held moral convictions about, you know, what equal treatment and those things. How does that, is there, what are the some of the best arguments that you can make that that is perhaps a First Amendment violation when it's mandated by the by a state Supreme Court?
I'll start here. I think one of the most pernicious aspects of DEI programming is that it's not just sitting here and listening. They're often what they call interactive and become struggle sessions. We have to basically admit all the times that you've been inadequately attuned to racial inequality. You have to admit all the times you've engaged in microaggressions. You have to basically apologize and genuflect. Many of these classes actually separate people by race, and they have the affinity groups and the white people, and they have to just say who's oppressed and who's an oppressor. They also take, again, as a given that this is truth, that this is gospel, right? There are rules. You cannot steal client funds. No one disagrees with that, right? You have to maintain client confidentialities. That's a rule. That's an actual premise of law that people don't disagree with. Now, maybe at the margins, there might be exceptions when you have to disclose things, abuse, commission of crime, and so on, but we agree. The idea that we live in a structurally racist society, and William quoted all the quotes from Ibram Kendi, and the government saying this is the truth, it's basically thought control. And if you disagree with it and you refuse to participate in it, you are then denied credit by the state. Or in my law school context, if you take these classes and say, this is all nonsense, I'm not going to affirm these things are true, you get a bad grade in a class. I do think this is a form of compelled speech and so form of compelled indoctrination, which is also in the medical profession. The group Do No Harm does some wonderful work where they basically make doctors basically, instead of learning how to save people's lives or learning about why we're all racist and just have to affirm these things to be a simple, you know, physician. There are serious common law issues here that in the wake of the George Floyd madness, people just sort of waltz past. And I think only now some sanity is prevailing. I mean, you know, we just changed Lake Ontario to Lake America. Maybe we can change the Sabre Island back to its old name. I don't know. There's hope.
Any comments from Dan or Professor Jacobson on that?
Yeah, I would just say, like, as far as these mandates, it's not, I don't think that the mandate, in my view, is the legal problem, because the language is typically so broad and people can interpret it how they want, and they can, and Bill can do his own DEI class. And, you know, I teach a class at UW Law School, which is certified as a DEI class. It is certainly not the traditional type of DEI class that you would imagine. So people, the mandate, I don't think is necessarily the problem. I think the legal issue is what is taught and who is teaching. Those are the two things that I think are the most important. So for example, in the employer side, there are continuing education requirements that are DEI requirements that are mandated by, like, say, employers, like large law firms or legal employers. And these may require employees to, like, affirm or oppose certain viewpoints on white supremacy, anti-racism, colorblindness. They'll do things like mandatory privilege walks where you have to actually affirmatively move up or down based on your privilege. They force employees to endure harassing statements about whites or Asians. And if this is a private employer requiring this, you've got possible race discrimination, racial harassment claims under Title VII or Section 1981. Also, there's a growing, you know, body of religious discrimination law under Title VII since Groff versus DeJoy, the Supreme Court case that put the burden on employers to justify why they aren't giving religious exemptions to employees. And so that's the, you know, that's sort of the, like the private. And so if there's public employers that are requiring this, like, you know, the state agencies or the federal agencies, you've definitely got a compelled speech issue under the First Amendment. You know, you've got claims under for race discrimination under the 14th Amendment or Section 1983. You've got claims for religious discrimination against a public employer. And we should, you know, always remember SFFA's twin commands. Race can never be used as a negative or a stereotype. Those are independent rules apart from the traditional strict scrutiny standard under SFFA. And so when the government is forcing you to endure a stereotype, I think the government employer has SFFA problems. There's a good recent case out of the Eighth Circuit called Henderson versus Springfield School District, which goes through, it's an en banc decision. It goes through in detail the type of sort of harassing, demeaning, stereotypical trainings that can be forced upon public employees and how that might violate constitutional standards. On the issue of these just bar associations, you know, mandating CLEs, you know, that's, I think, a compelled speech issue too. If your bar is forcing you to, number one, go to these things that require you to say something that you disagree with, so compelled speech, or that you are forced to associate with the bar itself, which is saying these things you don't agree with. So these are two types of claims common in litigation against bars, none of which have really been super successful yet, but we're working on it. First, the most successful type of claim is the Keller type claim, where a bar member sues the state bar, claiming that these programs are not germane to the regulation of the legal profession. And so their dues, they're actually money you give to the bar, can't be used on these DEI CLEs. So we sued the Wisconsin State Bar, alleging these claims that in our case is called Sir versus Wisconsin State Bar. We argued that race discrimination is never germane. So these DEI, when you're forcing someone to do something illegal or say something illegal, or you're advocating for illegal race discrimination, that's not germane. That is not something that your dues should be going to pay for. The bar, State Bar of Wisconsin, settled with us, and they ended a ton of discriminatory DEI programs. We got them to change their definition of diversity to remove race and to insert words pertaining to individuals and individual treatments. The second type claim, which is the claim that we're going to have to hopefully get to the U.S. Supreme Court, is the Janus claim. So Janus is the case that says you can't be forced to join a union and support a union under the First Amendment. That's compelled association. Janus has never been applied to state bars in the way that we really think it should be. Basically saying that if I have to be the member of a bar, you can't make me if I don't support everything the bar is doing, whether it's germane or not germane, whatever they're doing, these DEI CLEs, I disagreement. Why do I have to join that bar that you're saying is put on by the State Bar of Wisconsin, which I'm a member? So you're basically saying that I support that sort of speech. There are a couple cases pending. Just on Monday, the Tenth Circuit ruled against the plaintiff in the case against the Utah State Bar called Pomeroy. That's a Goldwater case. Goldwater has another case in Oklahoma called Shell, which is, I think, in the district court. But these cases have, like, every few years, they go up to the U.S. Supreme Court on cert. And I think Justice Thomas is the only one who's written a respecting denial in these. But the idea is that if we're going to force lawyers to join bar, are they giving up their First Amendment rights? Is this compelled association? And I think that's something that you know, we in the public interest community are really need to start focusing on to get rid of the mandatory state bar completely and to avoid all of this association with speech that you disagree with.
Thank you, Dan. Professor Jacobson, any comments before we move to audience Q&A?
The only thing I'll add to that is this is most pernicious and damaging in the employment context, because for all of us, we can go to our 1 hour CLE. For the most part, I don't think anybody's forced to express a viewpoint. You just have to sit there and, you know, check the box when it pops up on the screen to make sure you're there. But in the employment context, your job is on the line. Okay. And that's where I think we've seen a lot of the worst abuses. The entire consultant class, which provided this programming. And so I think that has subsided a lot. At least some major corporations have announced they're either eliminating or scaling that back. But there was an entire industry which grew up around this that probably still exists. That was the worst of it all. The HR department were the worst perpetrators of this repression.
Thank you. That's very helpful, insightful, all three of you. One last quick question before we go to audience Q&A that occurred to me. There's currently, in the context of legal education, several of us work at law schools, a controversy regarding ABA Standard 206 involved, and Josh referenced it in his opening remarks, involving diversity mandates for law schools as part of their accreditation standards. And it's currently suspended by the ABA Council, so it's not currently in effect, and they recommended repeal, or we're going to repeal it, send it to the House of Delegates. The House of Delegates back just last month in August recommended against repeal, and coming up in about a matter of less than a week, the ABA Council is going to be revisiting that and voting on whether to repeal Standard 206, which requires concrete action and cause a lot of concern as far as whether that action is that it's mandating for reaccreditation is something that would be contrary to existing Supreme Court law in the light of Harvard versus UNC. Anyway, with that said, any comments in terms of how you think that the ABA Council might go, whether that will have an impact in terms of this conversation or a ripple effect if they do repeal it on other the CLE piece or the other ways in which mandates relating to DEI are being undertaken? Any thoughts from any of the panelists on that?
I mean, even if the ABA repeals a recommendation, law schools are not going to change their practice. They want to do this stuff. So I suppose it eliminates the sort of compulsion by the creditor. I suppose at state law schools, there might be intervention by state legislatures. But until you sort of address the root cause that people in the legal profession believe that we need to teach this, and not much will change. Indeed, if the ABA loses its accrediting power, it won't even matter anymore. I think the more useful approach, and was a question in the chat about this, is to demonstrate that these standards are actually harmful. And I think Dan and Will can talk this more than I can, but I've never seen any study showing this actually helps to eliminate racism. In fact, it often has the opposite intended effect. People become so jaded by it that they basically tune out and they refuse to even consider that this stuff is valuable. Force feeding this sort of blame game on people that they are to blame for the evilness just sort of closes the mind, hardens the heart, if you will. And I think if you perhaps demonstrate that there's other ways of actually improving opportunities for people rather than this DEI madness, then maybe there's hope. But as long as people believe it's useful, they'll just sort of quietly creep it in and just call it, oh, we're not DEI, we're just equal opportunity, and we're you know, advancing opportunity and all these other acronyms.
Yeah, it's...
Yep, go ahead, Dan.
It is, I mean, the rule is encouraging lawlessness. I mean, the rule says, I mean, provide full opportunities. Okay, well, we all agree with that. Full opportunities to students and teachers and faculty and staff, to members of underrepresented groups, particularly racial and ethnic minorities. What is that other than telling law schools you ought to hire more Black professors? You ought to hire more Black professors because they're Black. You ought to admit more Hispanic students because they are Hispanic. That's lawlessness. And so the ABA can find, the ABA can do this. I mean, they're subject to Title VI. They receive federal money. We submitted a Title VI complaint against ABA, hoping the federal government would investigate that organization, which is a recipient of federal financial assistance. But also these law schools absorb this standard, whether mandated or not, whether they want to do it, they just do it by themselves. But they are federal financial assistant recipients, and the federal government can investigate them, and people can bring their own lawsuits based on Title VI, that you're accepting federal money and you are discriminating. You are discriminating explicitly by helping underrepresented groups based on race and ethnicity because of their race and ethnicity. And so at some point, you know, I know the Trump administration has battled with Harvard and tried to take away their money. At some point, some university is going to lose their meal ticket. And that's going to be where the rubber meets the road.
Thank you, Dan. Any last thoughts, Professor Jacobs, before I go to audience Q&A? Okay. All right, let's take a look here. I think a couple of these have already been touched on in the course of the conversation, so I'm going to take a look to find what's different. What is your opinion? Does anyone have an opinion from our panel on the efficacy of non-civil rights claims in fighting DEI CLEs, such as negligent misrepresentation or consumer protection deception statutes, or anything else of that kind? Any other theories that have been thought of, tried, considered?
Not sure, sorry.
That's okay. Any thoughts on that? I guess we've talked about the Title VII with regard to workplace.
I can only sort of think of title and civil rights, about this is discrimination based on race or religion or ethnicity, national origin. As far as torts are concerned, I think that'd probably be a stretch to seek a tort claim against someone. But I guess if the racial harassment is pervasive enough, you may encounter that.
Another question. Any thoughts on Pacific Legal Foundation's pending cert petition challenging California's mandatory implicit bias training for all continuing medical education courses? They're looking to another profession. I don't know if you have a familiarity in that area or familiar with those that matter.
Is this as part of the integrated California bar? Is that part of what the question might be asking?
I think it's for medical, so it's part of the medical, right? It's okay if you're not familiar with that. That's totally okay.
All right. A related point, and this sort of the question about challenging the case some years ago where there was a challenge to the Texas bar. My friend Josh Hammer was one of the plaintiffs in that case. And the Fifth Circuit basically didn't cut off the Texas bar entirely. They sort of said that the Texas bar cannot mandate any sort of DEI-related activity. And that might be sort of a middle ground unless the court revisits the Keller case. In other words, if they want to do this sort of DEI stuff, they can do it as voluntary, but not as part of the mandatory approach. That would cut against the sort of mandatory credits that Rhode Island and other states have implemented.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Any other comments on it before I move to the next question? We've already touched on JANA, so I have a question that says, do you think the U.S. Supreme Court will view mandatory state bars differently akin to JANA's with their adoption of coercive DEI CLEs and other political views for their attorneys? But you may have already touched on that in the comments on JANA's.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of time. I mean, it's like how many times, I don't know the exact number of cert petitions, but there's been a lot of cert petitions in the last 10 years or so going at mandatory state bars. If I had to guess, I think there's probably some fear and trepidation by the U.S. Supreme Court. And you know, they're always thinking like, what would happen? What would be the consequences of removing mandatory state bars? You know, there are integrated bars, and there are the idea that like you can separate the regulation of lawyers as lawyers, like you know, getting rid of bad lawyers or supervision of lawyers or ethical rules of lawyers or investigations and or passing the bar exam. That's that sort of thing is different than these bar associations, which do all sorts of stuff. Like in Wisconsin, our bar lobbies the legislature to change the law. Our bar writes op-eds and articles and advocates for positions. Our bar runs these DEI CLEs. And so the question I think is, you know, how are we going to separate between some of these fluffy things state bars do, like putting out tweets about eating right or having mental health breaks during your day, which some bars do if you follow them on X, versus the nuts and bolts of actually regulating the legal profession, like making sure people have licenses to practice law, making sure people keep their client funds segregated from their law firm funds, making sure they abide by the ethical rules and there's investigations. Those are sort of different things. So I'm eventually, the Supreme Court, I hope they would take a case and basically get rid of Keller and apply Janus. But I think there's probably some trepidation about it, what happens to the bars and the regulation of attorneys in America.
Okay. I have another question that's on here, but any thoughts on a legal theory challenging mandatory courses premise on a right against, quote, compelled listening, end quote? I guess touched on that on the compelled speech, but is it maybe it's a weaker argument, or at least one that hasn't been yet supported by existing law, but saying perhaps that the court is taking a position on a particular item and you're compelled to be in order to continue in your licensure, if you want to, you have to get this credit. If they compel you to listen to that, is that something that's solved by simply allowing flexibility, as apparently their efforts have been done to do, including today, right, to have these things qualify for credit but be open to a variety of viewpoints on the subject matter that's being discussed? Any comments on response to the question that was posed by the audience member on that, in addition to what's already been shared?
Yeah, I think the bigger problem is the viewpoint discrimination. So, for example, any state which requires DEI credit were to then say, this session you're listening to right now does not qualify, I think that would be a form of viewpoint discrimination. I think there's an abstract that you can't listen to things. I think just listening is okay. But I think when they dictate the content, that's where it sort of crosses the line.
Any other thoughts?
Yeah, the only compelled listening I can think of would be the idea of racial harassment. So that could be a Title VII problem in the employment context, a racial hostile workplace created by a continuing education requirement, or if required by the state, that the state is racially harassing an individual. Those would be obviously tough cases to make in that context, but I think it's possible.
Another question, this may have been alluded to, but just to maybe crystallize it, is there any pending litigation? I think Dan had talked about some of the successful litigation that had been resolved, but is there any pending litigation challenging the constitutionality of mandatory DEI CLE requirements, in addition to what's been mentioned already?
I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. Let's see if there's another one more. I think we have time for one more. If I can, I'm going to look in the chat as well, in addition to the Q&A, to see if there's something there.
There's a question about the ABA, which might be worth talking about as well.
Yes, thank you. The Trump administration efforts with the ABA. Thank you, Professor Blackman.
I'll take a stab there. So what happens here is kind of multi-pronged. A number of states, including Texas, Florida, Ohio, and others, have said that the ABA is no longer the sole accreditor in the state. But those states haven't exactly said what will replace it. So, for example, Texas said, well, if you're already ABA accredited, we'll treat you as accredited basically for the foreseeable future. So at least in Texas, where I go to school, the schools are still keeping their ABA accreditation. The second prong is the federal level. In order to receive what are called Title IV loans, you have to be an accredited law school. Virtually every law school in the country Is there any accredited not just through the ABA, but through some sort of regional accreditor through the university? Mine is not. I teach at an independent law school, so we actually have our own separate accreditation apart from the ABA. The Trump administration said that the ABA's renewal, which is up in 26, is probably not going to happen. They published a very lengthy report explaining why. DEI is just one of the many reasons, but also there's this close guild relationship between the ABA and the Council on Legal Education. And then they could have perhaps averted this by separating them entirely, but the ABA wants control over the regulation of lawyers. So the end game, right? I think the last ditch effort would be to spin off the Council of Accreditation as a totally separate entity. And that might not be a bad idea, but that may not be enough. The Trump administration might just say, this is the end. We'll have other creditors or just have no creditor at all. We can just have the regional creditors do law school and don't give the guild, the ABA, any sort of special power. I wrote a piece in Civitas the other day called The End is Near. This will be kind of the mortal death blow for the ABA, because at that point, it doesn't really do anything of use, right? This is their major thing to sort of shape the law. So look, they lose accreditation. Their model rules are not adopted, like 8.4G. Their attendance and registration numbers and membership continues to plummet. They have these lavish annual meetings that accomplish absolutely nothing. What the heck is the point of the ABA in 5 or 10 years? I don't even know. And it makes me sort of sad, because at one point, almost half the lawyers in the country were ABA members. This was a very well-regarded group. And they sort of just fixated that we need to sort of advance a liberal social agenda. We need to oppose, we need to favor abortion, oppose the death penalty, support terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, right? They pick every issue. And eventually the check comes due. And I think they only have themselves to blame for this.
Any other thoughts on that? Very, very well said. Okay. Let's see, I think we have 1 minute left to see if there's a quick question that I haven't picked up that we can. Any closing thoughts, I guess, in addition to any particular question, any last comments before we wind it down?
I'll just address a question that was in the chat, since I can't respond to people in the chat. My Rhode Island CLE program is not available to the best of my knowledge. It was not recorded. They don't post them on the internet, and it's not on the list of on-demand CLE programs. So if you didn't attend, there's no way to know what was said.
Thank you, Professor. Okay, thank you. I appreciate your great presentations that each of you did, and very thoughtful responses. I find myself in great agreement with each of you, so thank you. Having been a dean as well of a law school.
Well, thank you all so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I just want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and for your expertise today. I also want to thank you, our audience, for joining in and participating. For anyone seeking CLE credit, this is very important. The attendance reporting form has been linked in the chat box. You should see it below. Please complete this form now if you can. If you do happen to miss the link, it will be emailed to you within 1 day of the webinar. Your certificate of attendance upon completion of that form will then be emailed to the address you provide within 1 week, along with any credit reporting information for your state. And if you do not receive this follow-up, we ask that you please contact us at cle@fedsoc.org. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. As always, please keep an eye on our website and on your emails for announcements about any upcoming virtual events. And with that, thank you for joining us today, and we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.